I'm done with subscriptions. Streaming, fitness, razors, vitamins. I've got subscriptions for everything in my life. They lock you in, and half the time, I can't figure out how to unsubscribe. That's why I'm so excited about the new Blue Apron. Now you can get delicious meals delivered with no subscription needed, including new pre-made options. Keep the flavor. Ditch the subscription. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Yeah, I think this is the new official Hardline theme song. We just gotta get the big voice guy to say it's Hardline. We're good. This is good. Politics dancing. Welcome back. Beamer in for myself here on Hardline. News Radio 930 WBEN, hour number two. And we are joined by Congressman Brian Higgins. Congressman, good morning.
Morning, Joe. How are you doing?
Doing well, Congressman. Before we get into the list of topics that I wanted to bring up with you today, I wanted to know your thoughts on the Republican Party censuring two of your colleagues over the week.
Who were those colleagues?
Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger.
Yeah, look, I think everybody is duly elected and should be able to participate fully in Congress. They have differing views, obviously, on some topical issues, but they shouldn't be censured or removed from committees because of it.
This week, Congressman, the American Competes Act was announced, and what are the goals of this initiative?
Money create regional tech hubs like right here in Buffalo and Western New York, a collaboration between M&T Bank, the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus, the University of Buffalo, and others to make Buffalo relevant, to make Buffalo a technology ecosystem or community of interrelated and interconnected entities toward the goal of making Buffalo an attractive place for tech investment.
Well, I like that. Also announced this week, and you were there, was the president's initiative to cut cancer deaths in half in the next 25 years. What are the pieces of this plan put out by the president?
$6 billion to major cancer centers like Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center to take a promising new technology and advance it toward treatments that can save lives and improve people's lives. Roswell has a storied place in cancer research, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. The first comprehensive cancer center, chemotherapy was developed there. The prostate-specific antigen test, critical link studies between cancer and smoking. If you were to eliminate all smoking, you could reduce cancer deaths by some 40%. But Roswell is number 14 in the nation of comprehensive cancer centers, and we'll likely receive a good chunk of that money to develop new therapies in immunotherapy, also using the messenger RNA, which is the technology that developed the two COVID vaccines. It's the genetic material that tells a cell to make a protein, which is the active ingredient in the vaccine. It is highly effective, 90-95%, which makes it perhaps the greatest biomedical advancement achievement in the past 100 years. The idea is to use that technology for things like cancer, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's. So it will be research money, and with rock star researchers that we have at Roswell Park, they will bring with them that research money. So I think that we're well positioned with Roswell Park to take advantage of that initiative, the Cancer Moonshot. And we want, when those therapies are developed to treat cancer effectively, we want them founded in Buffalo and Western New York, right at Roswell.
So the idea of a cancer vaccine is very much a reality with this new technology?
Yeah, they're already using cancer vaccines for what's referred to as immunotherapy. So you take out, the T cells of the immune system, you treat them, and then you return them, and they become much more effective in both finding and fighting cancer. And that's, a good way to treat cancer because, traditionally, as you've had three options. One is to cut the cancer out with surgery. The other is to burn it out with radiation, and the other is to kill it with highly toxic chemicals. But there are side effects to all of that. If we can empower the body's immune system to both find and fight cancer with therapeutics and vaccines, that would go much further. So they're already using vaccines to ignite, to activate the body's immune system to find and fight cancer. We just want to be able to find and fight more kinds of cancer.
You also mentioned smoking. I know this money is going towards research, but would there also be a plan to put more anti-smoking messages out there to the public?
It could be. 89% of all lung cancers could be eliminated if you were to eliminate smoking. 40% of all cancers could be eliminated if you were to eliminate smoking. The point is, these studies are important to show the cause and effect relationship. So that could be, turned into more aggressive efforts to reduce smoking. So it just goes to the general category of lifestyles. The other thing that's very important here, Joe, is cancer screening or diagnostics. Less than 10% of cancer deaths are attributed to the original tumor. It's when cancer moves, when it advances, when it metastasizes, that's when it becomes lethal. So if you can detect cancer early, you can save more lives. So it's treatments, it's therapeutics, it's screening, it's a whole array of things. It's about $6 billion that the president is asking Congress to finance the cancer moonshot with.
Do you think that's going to have any issues in Congress?
I don't. I am co-chair of the Cancer Caucus. It's bipartisan, both Republican and Democratic members. I know that Republican members of the Senate, along with Democrats, all support cancer research. So I don't think this is going to have much trouble.
Also coming up this week, we've talked about it actually over the last 2 weeks, and that is the ongoing tension with Russia, the Russia situation. Where does that stand going into this week?
Well, Vladimir Putin, has a deep belief in the power of the state to control the life of the nation, and that's the media, the economy, civil society, politics, and non-governmental institutions. It's a situation where 100,000 Russian troops are situated along the border, threatening to attack Ukraine. Ukraine's a country of 44 million people. It's very poor. It's very corrupt. Russia is a country of 146 million people. And this has occurred before. And I think, the problem that Putin has with Ukraine, he's never accepted the legitimacy of the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, and therefore does not support the notion of an independent Ukraine. The other thing he is fearful of, he does not want Ukraine to become a model for democracy that his people in Russia can see. And if it's successful, they're going to want it. And that's his problem. Putin is paranoid. He's very provocative. And, he's concerned that if Ukraine, for example, were to join NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, whose first principle is a Europe whole and free, protecting the continent from Russian aggression, that will pose problems for him. So he escalates, then he seeks to use that as leverage, and then he pulls back. We don't know what's going to happen right now. The United States is assisting in the European effort here. NATO has a provision called Article 5, which is common defense. An attack on one is an attack on all. The first time it was invoked was on September 11, 2001. And that is, you know, the common defense provision. And Putin, again, does not want Ukraine to become part of NATO. Ukraine wants to become part of NATO.
Congressman, where do you see the likelihood that American troops will be involved?
I don't. I think that the United States will support the effort by supplying equipment and arms to other European nations, but I don't see the United States becoming engaged in a direct military conflict.
A few weeks ago, you were in town with Governor Kathy Hochul and Assemblywoman Crystal Peoples-Stokes talking about the covering of the 33 and what could happen. You know, what will happen down the line. What did you think of that presentation? And when will we start seeing the covering of the 33?
Yeah, the announcement was that commencing the starting of an environmental impact study, which is required by law. That will take about 24 months, and it'll look at various options as it relates to the 33 or the Kensington Expressway. And the whole idea here is that, you know, back in the late 1950s, when America was obsessed with the automobile, built a lot of expressways that plowed right through neighborhoods. And in this case, a beautiful Buffalo neighborhood, you know, when Frederick Law Olmsted came and designed a park system for Buffalo in 1868, it included six parks, but seven parkways, because he believed strongly in the healing powers of parks, an abundance of fresh air, an abundance of sunshine, and of social cohesion, that those parks had to be accessible to all. The grandest of the Olmsted parkways was Humboldt Parkway, and it was obliterated for an expressway. That did a terrible disservice to people in that community. So the study, over 24 months, will look to find the best way, the best alternative to restore Humboldt Parkway. And that's fair and reasonable and a long time in coming.
And then after that, because you and I have talked also about the 198 in the Skyway. Do you think this is the start of projects like that, of more projects like that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, keep in mind the $1.2 trillion infrastructure law, just to put it in historical perspective. When the New Deal was done in the 1930s, there were three iterations. It was approximately $41 billion then. In today's dollars, it would be about $680 billion. So now you've got $1 trillion. This will be the largest infrastructure investment in the history of the country. What we want to do is position Buffalo and Western New York to take full advantage of that by having projects that are shovel worthy, but also shovel ready. And that's why you do these studies, which again are required by law, to look at what the alternatives are. And in that way, communities have a choice as to whether to rehabilitate an old structure or to replace it because it's become functionally obsolete. So it will just put us in a better position to make smart decisions about Buffalo and Western New York's transportation future.
Congressman, before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about COVID federally and at the state level. You know, at the federal level, we had the website to get tests sent to residents here. Do you think that we are now on a federal level ahead of this? And what do you see as the next step when it comes to handling COVID-19?
Look, I think we're doing okay. I think New York State is doing better than they are doing at the federal level under our governor, Kathy Hochul. She's taking a smart, common sense, reassuring, empathetic approach to this. But the reality is this, Joe. The United States is about 4% of the world's population, and we have about 22% of the world's COVID deaths. So we weren't prepared for this. You know, prior to the establishment of the vaccine, the best thing our healthcare system could do was to give somebody Tylenol to relieve, you know, fever and pain. Now we have very powerful, effective vaccines. That is a good thing. The distribution of testing kits was slower than it needed to be, but it's getting much better. So, you know, we're doing better, but we have a long way to go.
How is the distribution of antivirals going at a federal level? Are there more on the way?
There's always going to be more. I mean, you have, you know, drug development, vaccine development is innovation. By its very definition, it's inefficient. It's trial and error. But there is more money focused on developing drugs, therapeutics, vaccines, so that we can handle the problem that we're currently dealing with. But we have to be prepared for the next one. And the truth is that COVID's not going away. This is SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, COVID-2, meaning there was a COVID-1, and there'll probably be a 3, 4, and 5. So the best thing that we can do is have the tools, the medications, the therapeutics, the vaccines, and then, you know, the social interventions about social distancing, physical distancing, to manage a public health crisis. And I think we're moving toward that phase, more of a constant management of the situation, because it's going to be around for a long time.
What do you think of students here in New York State still wearing masks? We saw the superintendent send a letter to the governor asking to let that expire on February 21st. What do you think of that going forward?
I think that public health officials in the medical field and in the infectious disease field are best positioned to make recommendations as it relates to masking for kids, for adults, social distancing, and everything else. I think, you know, a lot of this stuff becomes very politicized. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, this is a highly contagious, infectious disease. So I think we need to follow the recommendations of public health experts in the various fields of expertise.
Congressman Higgins, always appreciative of your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
That is Congressman Brian Higgins joining us on Hardline. If you missed any of that interview, you can hear it on WBEN.com and on the Odyssey app. You can also do that with our first hour. We had George Maziarz in studio. Coming up next, we have Erie County Legislator Tim Myers talking about the continued emergency powers for the county executive. It's Hardline on WBEN. Well, yes, welcome.
Why does every recipe I try need 18 ingredients, including a jar of something paste I'll never use again, but will sit in my fridge for 9 months? I just want dinner in the oven, fast. That's why I love Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals. They send you fresh ingredients that are already chopped. All you do is put it all together and bake. That's it. No chopping, no weird leftovers, just delicious, easy-to-make meals. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Back. It's the final segment of Hardline. In the final hour of Hardline, Joe Beamer with you here on WBEN. By the way, B-Maz and Beamer, it'll be Brian Mazurowski this week as I fill in on the afternoon show. So, you know, if you just keep your dial on WBEN all day, you have no reason to fear, because the news and talk will be here. Look at that. Make that the new slogan for the station. We are joined in our final segment by Erie County Legislator Tim Myers. Tim, good afternoon, or good morning.
Morning, Joe.
This week, Tim, there was a vote on a resolution that would have ended the powers of the county executive. And as expected, it went across party lines, 7-4. Why, at this time, do you feel it's important for the county executive to retain his emergency powers?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me here today. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. According to New York state law, the only ones who can terminate executive powers is the New York state legislature. The Erie County legislature does not have authority to terminate these powers. This is in New York state law, section 24-8. And I know there's been a little bit of difference of opinions on the other side, but that's our opinion, that we could not remove them emergency powers from the county executive. And we asked the question of what actual powers were they looking to strip from the county executive? And we really couldn't get a definitive answer on that. And it goes beyond just whether it's the New York state legislature that can do it or not. But that's our opinion. That's what our lawyers have told us, that we do not have the authority to do that. But just for the fact, almost every municipality is still under a state of emergency. being under the state of emergency, it allows us to get money for FEMA, New York State, federal government. You know, allows us to run pop-up sites, vaccine clinics, things of that nature. Like, we've just received 160,000 take-home test kits. We have another 300,000 on the way. But them are all things that could become in jeopardy by removing removing the emergency orders. But we believe that we do not have the authority to do so.
So would you say that the vote was more against the accusation that you can change these more than it was against his powers?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. But even if we, speaking for myself, even if we did have that, the authority to do so at this point, I don't think that right now we're ready to do this. We've just gone through this. I mean, thank God the numbers are coming down now. I believe it's around 4%. But we've seen where we were 2 weeks ago. They're at 23%. So nobody has a crystal ball. We don't know what's around the corner. And that's the way that we feel about this.
Do you, in your opinion, looking forward, as you said, the numbers continue to go down. It seems like this variant, this very contagious variant, is burning out. Do you see a month or two down the road where it might be appropriate to go to the state and or to just ask the county executive that it's time to remove those powers?
Yeah, I guess we would have to see where we end up on that. Again, ultimately, it is up to the state to remove those powers. You know, I think there's a little bit of, I don't want to taint the waters here, a little bit of gamesmanship going on here. You know, this pandemic and talking about removing emergency powers. I'd just like to say, our caucus, led by Chair Baskin, she just created a local law in the health equity office to respond to health care needs of the county's most vulnerable residents. Legislator Johnson, he's out in his district every day handing out masks, going to community centers, trying to help people in need. Legislator Vinyl just created a small business committee, which in turn has sent millions of dollars into the pockets of small businesses. Legislator Shamira, on her part, is putting her heart and soul into childcare, trying to increase the pay of workers, increase subsidies so parents can get back to work. We have a new legislator, John Barnese, who just joined our caucus in the last month, who brings a wealth of experience from his years on the town board in Tonawanda. He's going to be a great help. Legislator Gilmore, who represents Hamburg, over the past 24 months has had multiple food drives getting to the people who are struggling, who are out of work. My message is, our caucus, instead of putting up smoke and mirrors and putting out a false narrative, our caucus is providing real solutions to real problems to real people of Erie County. And I don't think that the people have been getting the truth the whole time, and I just want to try to lay the facts a little bit straight.
And Tim, obviously, we'll have someone from the other caucus next week to address that. My question, and you kind of already addressed this, but... my question is, say those emergency powers were taken away. The county executive does have the majority. Now, I know that the thought is that the state has to take it away, and I understand that. But with the majority, what is, and like I said, you touched on this, but maybe just say it again. What could the county executive not accomplish if he did not have these powers that he's doing now?
Well, that's the question that we asked. What are they looking to take away? I mean, we had some unanimous votes on this COVID response when it first came out about the money, giving him freedom to spend the money. Then we had a unanimous vote to stop his powers of spending up to $500,000, entering into contracts. It's been lowered down to $10,000. I mean, just some of the things under $10,000. It just, like I said, it just gives him a little bit of free rein to for clinics, vaccine clinics, testing clinics, things of that nature. Now there are other things too. People talk about masks and stuff. There's a mask mandate, which under the state powers, he could have a mask mandate. Which right now, if he got rid of it, it doesn't matter. It's superseded. There's a state mandate. Also, the health commissioner has that power under New York State health law. She could mandate a mask mandate. So I don't really know. I think it's minimal. But the thing is, if you take them away and something happens, you lose that ability to do, you know, the day-to-day things. And as we've seen from the beginning of this whole thing, it's the unknown is more than the known.
So at the end of this, so say, you know, 3 months from now, we're at, you know, 2% positivity, and there is an agreement in the legislature that those emergency powers are no longer needed by the county executive. Is it the Democrats in Erie County's belief that they have to propose this at a state level to get these finally taken away?
Yeah, that's our belief that we, you know, they could do it. They could do it at any time. State legislature may terminate by concurrent resolution such emergency orders at any time. They don't need us to tell them. I mean, they have the item. They're all in the districts here. They know what's going on. They see what's going on around the state. They could terminate them tomorrow if they so chose.
Tim, I also want to look, you know, with COVID, we know this has been getting even more talked in the emergency powers, and that's the overtime given to the health commissioner. What do you think of the overtime that was given to the health commissioner? And have you seen what was done for that overtime to be earned?
Well, I don't have a copy of the health commissioner's diary, but I'll tell you this, right? She is the health commissioner of a county that's bigger than three or four states. Now, nobody's seen anything like this coming. I don't think that the average person knows exactly what the doctor's doing. I mean, she was coordinating with hospitals, hospital staffs, testing sites. We're lucky to have her. I mean, what's the response? If they wanted to stop her overtime, then we could hire three more doctors. What do you do when it's done? I think she's earned every penny of what she's received. I'm thank God that we have her. She's been accessible. She's a wealth of knowledge, and I'll stand by the doctor every day.
Tim, looking at another thing that I know the legislature has a little communication on, but I'd like to know your thoughts on the ongoing Bills Stadium negotiations. Do you have any idea of where we are on that, and do you trust that the county executive will get the deal done?
Well, I'm hopeful that he'll get it done. We haven't really heard anything. You know, it's it's like anything. Negotiations are not done in public. I'm not privy to any of that information. I hope that, like everybody, that we get it done. I'm confident the county executive will get us there. And listen, it's a long process, and when hopefully an agreement will be reached, and then when it is, it'll be brought to us, and that's when we'll take our time and with all the rest of our colleagues on the legislature and do our due diligence and look into it, and hopefully we get something at the end of the day.
Erie County Legislator Tim Myers. Tim, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Thanks.
That is Erie County Legislator Tim Myers, Democrat in the legislature, talking about the emergency powers and also the overtime and the Bills Stadium. When we come back, Erie County Legislator Joe Lurigo will give his thoughts on what happened this week here on WBEN. Welcome back. It is Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN. Now, if I was really good at planning things out, I would have had this planned out already. But luckily, Erie County Legislator Joe Lurigo is there last minute to join us. Joe, good morning. Thank you for joining me on such short notice.
Morning, Joe. My pleasure. I'm glad I was available.
Tim Myers was on the last segment talking about the Democrats' vote to not get rid of the emergency powers. It was a 7-4 vote, and I wanted your reaction to the vote not passing.
I was disappointed. You know, we gave two different options. They could have eliminated the emergency powers immediately, or they could have eliminated them in 2 weeks at the end of our next legislative session. If they believed that the county executive, that his regulations and rules should remain in place, they could have put them in place themselves. They could have waited for the county executive to put them through the legislative process again and taken votes on those. Instead, my colleagues across the aisle voted basically to abdicate their duties and let the county executive keep running the show without a legislative process. And as I said on Thursday, I think it's a disservice to the people that they represent, and it's not the way government should be run.
Now, according to Legislator Myers, he said that the Democrats don't believe they have the power to take these emergency powers away. My question is, well, when is it going to be the time? I can't imagine the state just stepping in all of a sudden saying, oh, here, your powers are taken away.
Well, you know, that's an interesting take that he gave you. And the fact of the matter is, the county executive is required to do things via legislative resolution. The legislature can direct the county executive and his administration to take certain actions. I believe that we could have directed him to end the emergency declaration. But even when they brought that point up, I said, okay, if you think that we don't have that power, then I'm even willing to make an amendment and change the language from direct to request, meaning we would have made a legislative request that the county executive end the state of emergency and get back to the legislative process. My Democratic colleagues refused even to ask the county executive to end the emergency declaration. They're happy with him running everything under, you know, his total control with one person. They don't want a seat at the table. It's quite frankly, as a legislator, it's mind-boggling that you wouldn't want to do the job that you were elected to do, and you wouldn't want to be that voice for your constituents.
You know, looking around the state, other counties have ended their emergency powers. I realize some took it back with the Omicron variant. Are you aware of any other county that went to the state to get those taken away, or were those taken away at the county level?
It's my understanding that Erie County is the only county that has tried to get the state to intervene and end the continued emergency declaration, because Erie County is one of the only counties, if not the only county, that has had a continual state of emergency since March of 2020. I know the county executive claims that Albany County never released theirs or never relinquished theirs. But even if that is the case, there's two counties in the entire state that have been operating under a perpetual state of emergency. That is not the way government should run. You know, I think we all know New York State is no longer operating under a state of emergency. I believe that the vast majority of states in the United States aren't operating under a state of emergency. The legislative process has been restored virtually everywhere else. It's time that it's restored in Erie County as well.
And this was my point to Legislator Myers. The Democrats have a 7-4 majority. I really can't see what the county executive can't do if it was put back into the legislature. Has that point been made as well?
Oh, I made that point several times. That's why we gave them the two options. You know, they could have ended the emergency declaration in 2 weeks, and if the county executive really wanted to put these rules and regulations in place, they could have gone through the legislative process, and my Democratic colleagues could have voted for them. I think, you know, what they're trying to avoid is they're trying to avoid any responsibility for these decisions. They don't want to have to answer their constituents. They don't want to tell their constituents that they put these restrictions in place. They want to be able to use Mark Poloncarz as the scapegoat and say, he's the one making all the decisions. I as a legislator didn't do it. But the fact of the matter is, they've been complicit in their refusal to end the emergency declaration.
You know, this week we saw the superintendents from Erie County, Niagara County, a lot of counties, send a letter to Kathy Hochul about masking in schools. And my question to you is, if the state lifts the mask mandate on children, how likely do you think the county will lift that mask mandate in schools?
You know, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens. I saw that Governor Hochul said that there's going to be an announcement coming soon. But, you know, as far as I've seen Mark Poloncarz, he wants to be the one with all of the control. He wants to make sure that, you know, his restrictions are the toughest, his restrictions are the tightest. And, you know, it's causing problems for people all across Erie County. And, you know, rather than working together with people who might not agree with him, he simply shuts everybody out and refuses to do the right thing. He refuses to acknowledge that we're partners in government, and he calls people that don't agree with him his political opponents. I mean, we're all elected to these offices. We all represent constituents. Those constituents deserve a voice, and Mark Poloncarz should work with everybody, whether they agree with him or not.
Last question, Joe. Has there been any movement, anything on the overtime given to the health commissioner? Have we seen timestamps, what the county benefited off that overtime?
No, the Democrats in the legislature refused to have the conversation on overtime. They refused to look into it any further. And now with the new controller in place, I'd be shocked if we ever got any of that information.
Erie County Legislator Joe Lorigo. Joe, thanks again for joining me on such short notice.
Anytime. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too. That is Erie County Legislator Joe Lorigo. Before him, Erie County Legislator Tim Myers. Before him, we had Congressman Brian Higgins. And in the first hour, State Senator George Maziarz. If you missed any of that, I recommend you take some time this afternoon and listen on demand at WBEN.com or on the Odyssey app. We will be back here with live local programming tomorrow morning starting at 5 a.m. with a new morning. BMAZ and Beamer with just BMAZ. David Bellavia, 10 to 2. Myself, Joe Beamer, in for Tom Bowerly, 2 to 6. And Buffalo's Evening News with Tom Puckett, 6 to 7. I hope you have a great afternoon, whatever it is you are doing. Enjoy doing it, and we'll see you back here tomorrow on News Radio 930 WBEN.